Hello, everybody. My name is Hartmut Kaiser. I'm working at the Louisiana State University, and I'm leading a group there. It's called the Stellar Group, where we focus on writing or focus on parallelism and everything around C++ in that regard. Today, I want to talk about our experience with implementing different kind of parallelism in C++, very much oriented on the ongoing standardization effort, starting with the parallelism TS and other things. The main outcome we learned while implementing all of that is that you can use task-based parallelism as a basis for all higher-level APIs in C++, and that works very well. Even if you can implement all kind of a very broad kind of parallelism, like asynchrony, continuation-based parallelism, fork-join parallelism, and so on, I would like to focus on the parallelism TS today. So those parallel algorithms which now have been or will be added to C++ 17, hopefully. okay. But first, allow me to give you three slides about HPX, which is a runtime system we've been using to implement all of that. It's a library we've been developing for years, and I really give you these slides about HPX just to give you a background where all of that has been implemented and to show you what you can use to play with it today, to take the parallel algorithms as they will be in C++ 17 today and just try them out, write your applications with them. And later on, all you have to do is to change the namespace from HPX colon colon to standard colon colon, and you get exactly the same behavior, same semantics. HPX is a general purpose runtime system for applications of any scale. And by that, I mean applications which run on the Raspberry Pi on one end or on the petascale machines on the national labs on the other end. Hundreds of thousands of cores and two cores on the Raspberry Pi. And the same runtime system is usable on all of those. It's a general purpose runtime system for applications of any scale, as I already said. We made a very large effort to implement a API which is absolutely standards conformant in terms of semantics and syntax. So it gives you a very uniform and standards oriented API to write your applications. On the other hand, you can write fully asynchronous code using hundreds of millions of threads. And even on my laptop, I can run applications which run 100 million threads without any problems. The interesting part here is that since we want to run on the big machines as well, not only on desktops or on smaller embedded devices, we provide you a unified syntax to write applications which abstract the notion of locality from you. So your code looks the same regardless whether the code, the operation has to be performed locally to the invocation or remotely on a different node. Just a short rundown what HPX actually consists of. And you will see that essentially what we implemented there is a set of features, a set of facilities which are known for decades. And just by putting them together, we kind of get new, completely new emergent properties which allow us to implement these nice things, which I will talk about in this talk. It sits on top of a global address space. That might not be that important in the context of this talk, but it's very important when you're talking about distributed applications running on thousands of nodes, because what you want to do, local global load balancing of your data, and that means you want to move around things from one node to another. And by providing a global address space, that moving around of data doesn't change the address of that data item, which is very important. On the other hand, it's built on top of fine-grained parallelism and very lightweight synchronization. The overhead for creating a thread, scheduling it, running it, destroying it is in the range of 800 nanoseconds. So it's very cheap to create a thread and to run things on it. We combined that with a work queue-based message-driven computation, not only locally, like you know it from TBB or from Silk, but also remotely. So it's a departure from the common bulk synchronous programming paradigm which people use nowadays to write their distributed applications, mostly based on MPI. I already mentioned the full semantic equivalence of local and remote execution, and we have explicit support for accelerators and vectorization, and I will show you a couple of examples later on. It's completely open source. You can download it from GitHub. It's been released under the Boost license, so no strings attached whatsoever. You can use it forever for whatever you want. We certainly would like to hear back when you use it, but you don't have to tell us even. And the nice thing we believe why it might be interesting for you to look into HPX is you can very nicely use it for a platform for research and experimentation. And you can, on the other hand, already today play with the features which your compilers will give you hopefully tomorrow. A quick overview about what the structure of HPX is, but I'm not going to drill down too much into the details. For subsystems, threading, local threading, synchronization, the address space, and the networking layer, sitting on top of the operating system and exposing a C++ standards conforming parallelism API on top. All of that combined with a performance counter framework, which allows you to measure all kind of different things in the runtime system, in the application and the operating system, hardware performance counters as provided by the chips, exposed through a uniform interface, and some tooling support, which allows to tie in what we call policies, which look at these performance counters and allow it to do the runtime adaptive decisions on what to do next and turn the knobs in the system itself. Things like queues, lengths, wait times, memory distributions, and so on and so on. You can analyze that very nicely. In this talk today, I will focus on the parallelism APIs and specifically on the parallelism TS, the parallel algorithms. In general, the API HPX exposes, as I said, is oriented strictly on the existing standardization standards and on the standardization efforts. So we try to track many of the proposals related to parallelism and concurrency in HPX early on and give feedback, develop extensions which we feel are very interesting for us and our application development, and try to feed that back into the standardization process. Well, in short, essentially everything you have in the standard, you have something very equivalent in HPX, and you might ask, hey, why did you re-implement all of that stuff? Why did you re-implement thread, mutex, futures, async, and so on and so on? Well, there are several reasons why we did that. First, we wanted to support distributed computing from the very beginning, and we wanted to provide these facilities in distributed computing so that you could just bind a function on one node, send it over the wire, and invoke it on the other node. Or just do a async, which gives you a lightweight future, which is implemented on top of a very lightweight threading system, and gives you the latencies and the overheads very the low overheads I already mentioned. We implemented a couple of extensions to those standards APIs, and as I said, we are trying to feed that information back into our work with SG1, with SG14. Okay. So if you look at the picture, at the big picture, what does it mean to have parallelism? And what are the things you're interested in controlling when you want to expose various facets of the parallelism to your user? on the uppermost level, the application probably will deal with fairly high level things like parallel algorithms, some fork join parallelism, some asynchrony, some continuation style programming, and so on and so on. All of that we have implemented on top of three facilities, essentially. Futures, async, and a function which we call Dataflow. And I will talk about what Dataflow actually does in a second. And these three facilities kind of sit on top of a three concepts. The execution policies, that are those objects which are already defined in the parallelism TS and which have been added to C++ 17. And those execution policies are there to express restrictions of your code you want to run in parallel. Essentially, if you use a sequential execution policy, that means it tells a system, hey, the code I provide as a lambda for my parallel for loop is not allowed to run in parallel or concurrently. It has to run sequentially. If I use a parallel execution policy, I allow the system to run things concurrently in parallel. Execution policies are tied to executors. That's an ongoing discussion, and currently there's a lot of work being done to coin out the details of those executors. What we have implemented is an early proposal which was developed mostly by NVIDIA and which is the basis for the executor standardization work which is currently being discussed. Executors are essentially objects which represent the where and when of execution. Where do I want to run this particular task and when do I want to run it? What we added to it is what we call executor parameters. That's things which allow us to further modify the behavior of the executors, things like grain size. So how many of the iterations of this for loop do I want to run in one go, and how do I want to chunk up the work? This kind of things, and many other things, and I will show a couple of examples later on. If you look at what the standardization, how the standardization landscape looks today, then we see we have the parallelism TS, which is mostly concerned with iterative parallelism, which has been moved to be included in C++ 17, and I really hope it will make it into C++ 17. The concurrency TS, which is defining extensions for asynchrony, for task-based continuation-style parallelism. There are task blocks for fork join parallelism of heterogeneous tasks. That's a proposal submitted by Intel, which is currently being discussed. As already mentioned, executors, and last but not least, resumable functions or coroutines with compiler support for coroutines, which are very important for us as well, and I will show a couple of examples for that. What's currently missing in the standardization from our perspective is the integration of all of the above. So these things are all very interesting, but they are not very well aligned one with another. There's a question of creating or extending the ranges proposal into the parallel world. Nobody is working on that as far as I can see so far. Vectorization is already being discussed. And there are still extensions for GPUs, many core distributed or high performance computing. And that's where we try to define and find abstractions which can be used efficiently to integrate all of these things into one big package. In my point, the goal has to be to make parallelism in C++ independent from helper libraries like OpenMP or OpenACC. If I had a wish by C++ 20, I'm not sure if that's possible, but that's what we are striving for. HPX itself as a library allows us to make C++ independent of MPI as the underlying networking or programming model for distributed applications as well. Okay. I mentioned futures, and just to be sure that everybody's on the same page here and everybody understands what the future is, and because futures are for us, at least in HPX, kind of the central, very crucial facility we use to build all kind of parallelism, all kind of synchronization on. I would like to talk about those for a second. So in essence, a future is an object which represents a result which has not been computed yet. Essentially what happens is you have one thread of execution which creates that future object. And when that future object is created, a new thread is being spawned which executes another task. And the original thread can go forward with executing other work until to a point when it actually needs the result of that spawn thread. And at this point, it looks at the future, and if the future has received the result of that parallel execution already, then it just goes ahead. If not, then the current thread is put to sleep and will be resumed when the result arrives. This is a very nice synchronization model and allows us to completely abstract ourselves from the notion of a thread, which is very important because I personally believe that dealing with low-level threads is very, very painful, and people are just not wired to think in terms of threads. And if you have to deal with 2 threads or 10 threads, that might be okay, but as soon as you have to deal with millions of threads, it's completely impossible to model in your head how that works. So this kind of model of or using future objects enables us very transparent synchronization with the producer. It hides the notion of dealing with threads, which is, in my book, the most important thing. It makes asynchrony manageable, and it allows for composition of several independent tasks in building a task dependency tree, as we will see in a second. The last point turns concurrency into parallelism. I put that in parentheses because futures actually don't do that. But as soon as you start using futures for the synchronization, you kind of end up with a programming model where you have to deal less with concurrency and you can focus more on the parallelism. So it's a very, very nice way to write code where you, in my experience, have a lot less concurrency problems like data races and so on and so on. So a small example. We want to calculate the universal answer to life, to universe, and everything else. Well, we know that it's 42, but we also know that calculating that answer requires 7.5 million years, unfortunately, if you follow the literature. So let's create a function which we call deep thought. That's our computer. And what that computer does, it just calls async and launches that async, that universal function, that function which calculates the result, on a new thread. Async returns us a future object which represents the answer which the function will deliver at some point in the future. Then we go on with our lives for 7.5 million years because, well, we have lots of other things to do while this answer is being computed. And at some point we come back and say, hey, now the 7.5 million years are over, now I want to get the result. And what you do, you call get on the future. And two things can happen. Either the result has been computed and has been delivered back to the future object, then this will just grab the value and go ahead. Or the value has not been calculated yet, it has not been returned to the future, and then get will internally suspend the current thread, completely invisible for the caller. And as soon as a value is delivered, the thread will be resumed and the call returns from get and returns and continues as if nothing happened. So the caller will not even know whether the thread was suspended or not. All it knows is that when get returns, it has the result of the function. And that's a very nice way of abstracting these anonymous consumer producer scenarios. And as you can see, there's not a single notion of thread or of synchronization of whatever. It's very nice, straightforward code. And in HPX, we use futures as the central building block for all kind of synchronization, for all kind of parallelism, and that worked very well for us. Okay, parallel algorithms. You might know that the parallelism TS essentially defines to implement or specifies these 80 algorithms or so, which we all know and love from the STL, and it specifies them to be parallel or to be parallelizable. What the essence there is that they are very similar to standard library facilities we know for years, but they have one additional first argument, which is the execution policy. And the standard currently defines three execution policies, if I remember correctly. I will focus on two of them at this point. The most important ones are PAR and SEC. Well, PAR means that the code is allowed to run in parallel. My lambda I pass to the for each is allowed to be to run in parallel. And SEQ just means, hey, no parallelization is allowed. I'm not allowed to run that code concurrently. Execution policies have a standard default executor associated with them. And this is how we implemented it in HPX. So essentially, PAR is associated with a default parallel executor, and SEQ, SEC, is associated with a default sequential executor. What we also implemented is that you can rebind the executor and the executor parameters to the execution policies. And you can do that in a very simple way. That code example shows you a parallel fill. I left that namespace parallel in front of it, even if the standard doesn't do that. In the standard, it's still std colon colon for each or std colon colon fill. But just to make it clear that I'm talking about the parallel versions of those algorithms, I usually have the parallel colon colon, the namespace in front of it. So as you can see, the last arguments are the same as for the old venerable std find fill we know, but you pass that additional argument there as a first argument, which means, hey, that fill can be actually executed in parallel, as simple as it is. So if you want to use a different executor, you can do that very simply by doing par.on. .on allows you to bind a new executor, and I will talk about executors in a bit more detail later. A new instance of an executor to this parallel execution policy, which will, and if that executor, for instance, limits execution to a particular NUMA domain in your system, then this standard fill algorithm will run code only on this particular NUMA domain. Or if that executor limits execution to a GPU, then std fill will run the code on a GPU, and so on and so on. And the nice thing is you as a user can provide your own and develop your own executor objects, which will have a very simple interface. And you can control the operation of this parallel algorithms by providing your own executor object, which encapsulates your particular needs in terms of execution. Where, remember, executors means where and when are things executed. The .wiz is an extension we implemented in HPX, which allows you to add additional parameters to the executor to tell the executor additional parameterization things, like what's the chunk size, what's your chunking policy, and so on and so on. And I will have a couple of other examples on the next slides. So again, what you can do, take an arbitrary execution policy, rebind only the executor, for instance, or rebind only the executor parameters when you want to rely on the default executor, which is already pre-bound to the parallel execution policy, or you can rebind both. It's as easy as that. Or if we go to our PAR example again, so PAR was a rebound executor, or was a rebound, both of them rebound to your executor and your parameters object. Okay. What we additionally added in HPX to those execution policies which the standard defines, and there's currently a proposal which is being discussed in SG1, which we submitted a paper, a proposal is currently being discussed to turn the algorithms into asynchronous algorithms. Normally, when you invoke a parallel algorithm, it will return only once all the algorithm has been finished computing. But wouldn't it be nice if you could just kick off the computation, let it run somewhere, and get a future back, which represent the finalization of that particular algorithm execution? And the way we did that is just by allowing to specify a task modifier with the execution policy. So if you write par of task, then the algorithm actually will not run sequentially synchronously as you know it, but it will just kick off the operation and give you a future which represents the all execution of the algorithm. And the same we have implemented for the sequential execution policy as well. That gives you two new execution policies, a parallel task execution policy and a sequential task execution policy. In all those cases, the formerly synchronous functions return a future. The parallel construct will be executed asynchronously on a site, and you can go ahead with on the current thread with other operations and synchronize on your own time with a return future, which allows to integrate these parallel algorithms very nicely into other asynchronous control flows, which is very, very powerful feature. Another thing we did there, based on the data par work which is currently done to integrate vectorization with C++, we implemented four other execution policies, which we for now called data par and data par task, that might conflict with other names. So please take all those names with a grain of salt. We can discuss those, we can change those. But just for the sake of the discussion, let's assume that the execution policies are called data par and data sec. And those execution policies don't do anything in terms of parallelization or not parallelization, but what they do, they transform the code in a way so that your lambda can be vectorized. So if you have mostly arithmetic operations or other vectorizable operations in your lambda, then the code will be transformed in a way that your lambda is not invoked with the value type of your containers, but with a special type, which is a vector pack, essentially, which is pre-initialized by the underlying implementation, and your lambda will work on the vector pack instead of the original value type. And I will give you some examples later on about that. Currently, we have built that on top of an external library, which is VC. It's a library written by Matthias Kretz, one of the authors of one of the vectorization proposals which is currently being discussed. I'm in contact with Joel. Is Joel here? Joel Falcou? I think he has a talk in Perl. Yeah, he's talking currently. And we want to do the same integration with BoostSimD, which is an equivalent library he is currently developing. The only caveat there is that it requires the use of generic lambdas or polymorphic function objects, because the algorithm transforms the code and the data types. Your lambda now has to be instantiated with several different data types for the plain value type and for the pack and so on and so on. But that is shouldn't be a problem. It's just nice to know. So a bit more about executors. What is an executor? Executors must implement one function, in our implementation at least. Note that might change. As I said, there is currently a lot of discussion going on in the standards committee. We have a weekly phone call where these things are being discussed. Michael talked about that this morning a bit more detail. For us, executors need to implement one function, which is called async execute, and you give it a variadic, or in this case, it's a nullary function object, but we implemented a variadic interface, which launches that function with a given set of parameters and gives you a future back. And that's how that is done is completely up to the executor instance you're dealing with. And we access those executor functions through a traits object. And this might change as well. People in the current discussion might go in the direction that there will not be a single traits object, but a special overload for each of the functions, but that's details. So And that traits object is important because what you might, there are essentially five functionalities you want to get from an executor. A fire and forget operation, run that at some point, I don't care about the result. Run that asynchronously, give me a future of which represents the result of that function. Run that synchronously, I will wait for it. And two functions for bulk async and bulk sync operations, which allow to run many tasks, which is important in the GPU context or for loops and things like that. And what the traits do, the traits are able to simulate part of that functionality if the executor doesn't implement all of those functions. So it's very simple to implement an executor in the end, because all you have to do, you implement one function. And everything else can be emulated on top of that one function, and the traits will do that for you. Yeah, both of the async calls return a future. The single function async and the bulk async return a future. So you can synchronize with a work. Just to give you a couple of examples of executors we implemented, sequential executors, obviously parallel executor, that's the default ones which are bound to the execution policies. Is this thread executor, which guarantees that things are executed on this thread. A distribution policy executor, which allows you to tell, hey, I want to run it over there on this node, or please, here's a set of nodes, you decide on your own where you want to run things. A parallel executor, I will talk about that a bit later in more detail, which allows you to specify the NUMA domain or constrain the set of cores you actually want to run that code on, very important. Or a CUDA executor, which you can use to run things on a particular device connected anywhere in your system, and so on and so on. Okay, a word about the executor parameters. We implemented the same scheme as for the executor-executor traits pair. We called it parameters and executor parameters traits. Various execution parameters are possibly, you can be specified. Some examples there are, as I already said, control the grain size of work. How do you chunk up your loop when you parallelize it? That's very similar to what OpenMP does with the static, dynamic, guided chunking policies. But it allows you much more fine control because you can define your own chunking policy easily just by implementing one function which tells you the algorithm how to chunk up things. We use it for our parallel algorithms, obviously, to be able to control how things are being chunked. Another example, if you deal with certain systems and GPU integration in the compiler tool chains is not too great nowadays. We have to deal with several vendors. CUDA is one, Circle from CodePlay is one, HC or AMD has their own tool chain to integrate GPUs. And all of them have some quirks where you have to specify or give your kernel, which has to be run on the GPU, a unique name, because the compiler is not able to figure that out, so the programmer has to give that name. And that would be, for instance, one of the executive parameters, giving the GPU kernel a name. Another example, and I will have an example in the very end, some measurements for that, is do simple array prefetching, so that you can automatically prefetch certain iterations ahead of time, so that when the execution comes to that iteration, the values will be already loaded into the caches and things like that. Again, you can write your own executor parameters and implementations of that easily and customize the way these algorithms actually work. Okay, that's one part, namely placement of execution, where to run things, how to run things, when to run things. Another problem when you deal and when you want to make parallelism efficient is that you have to be able to control data placement. Where is my data? Which is on a single node that might not be that important as long as you're not dealing with NUMA effects in your algorithms, because no matter where the data is placed, all cores can access all data in the main memory. But when you're dealing with 5 GPUs connected to your system, you better place the data on the GPU where you're going to run the code, otherwise it will fail. So data placement is a very important second facet, and I would like to give you some ideas what we can do in that regard and how we can expose data placement to the user in a very, very generic and very nice way. Generally, there are different strategies you have to implement for different platforms. As I already said, for NUMA architectures, you use one way. For GPUs, you use something completely different. And for distributed systems, if you want to do data, make data placement efficient and do load balancing across nodes, then in distributed systems, you have to do completely different things. What we decided to go for is, again, the same as we did with everything else. We just took what the standard has, in this case, the standard allocator and the allocator traits, and extended those for the use cases we had in mind to make it more efficient. Essentially, what we did, we added additional functions to the standard allocator for bulk operations, for allocation, deallocation, construction, destruction, which is very useful when you want to work with data on the GPU, for instance. But generally, it's really just a linear extension of the allocator interface. Additionally, we added our own implementation of, vector, I'd say, implementation and a data type which we called partition vector. We added the vector with a special, with full allocator support, and which takes advantage of the extensions of our of the allocator extensions we implemented to give you the same interface as a standard vector, which allows to manage the data locality through that allocator, and which uses the execution target, and I will talk about targets in a minute, for the data placement. The nice thing here is that it allows to do direct manipulation of data on a GPU, for instance, from the GPU and from the CPU at the same time. So it has special magic implemented so that we can access the data from both ends. Partition vector is a data structure we implemented mostly for the distributed case. Essentially, it's a object which looks like a standard vector, but the data is not contiguous. It's chunked up into partitions, and those partitions can be located on different nodes in a system or on different GPUs in a system. And the chunks or the partitions taken together form the data managed by this partition vector. So it's a segmented data store where the segments themselves are the HPX vectors again, obviously. And you can use different things to decide how to distribute these partitions over the machine and so on and so on. I will give you a code example in a minute. As I already mentioned, it involves extending the allocator traits as well. Well, if you extend the allocator, you want to extend the traits as well, with functionality which allows us to copy data. That's very trivial for CPUs. But as you know, when you work with GPUs, you have to explicitly move the data from CPU to the GPU in order to work on it. And we extended the allocator traits, which allows us to do that in a very, very efficient way, allowing to overlap the move, the data movement from the CPU to the device and back with local work on the CPU. Well, in distributed, that maps onto network, possibly a remote DMA operations and so on. And that's implemented in our networking layer. I'm not going into any details here. We added the functionality to access single elements. Again, on a CPU, that's trivial. On the GPU, if you want to access a single element over the from the device, from the CPU, that's certainly expensive, but for debugging purposes, sometimes that's nice. The same is true for the network. If you really want to grab only one value, you can do that. You might not want to do that all the time, but for debugging purposes, that might be useful. Okay. We introduced a type which we called execution target. And again, the name can be changed. We are not attached to it. But what we need by, mean by a target is essentially just a place in the system where the data can be located and the execution is kind of connected to it. And we use these target objects to A, create an allocator to do the data placement, and B, to create an executor to co-locate the execution with a site where the data is located. Several types of those targets, for instance, CUDA target or a host target or a distributed target and so on, and you can implement your own. Then we initialize the allocator from those targets, which gives us a NUMA domain target when we use a host target, or a GPU device allocator, which allows to allocate data on a GPU, or a locality-based target, allocate data over there on this node, please. The same target object will be used for creating the executor, and that guarantees that the executor will run things exactly where the data is located, and that's what you want to achieve in the end. So this target allows us to abstract the data placement and the execution placement and give the user full control while still utilize all the predefined facilities in the parallel algorithms or in other parallelization facilities in the system. So it's really just a set of customization points, essentially. We give you as a user so that you can control what the parallel algorithms and all the other parallel facilities we expose do and how they work what are the specifics. Okay, let me give you some results, and that might clarify a lot of these things. This example is taken from Sean Perrin's talk a couple of years ago. And what he did there is said, okay, I have a sequence of elements, and some of the elements have a flag set, and some of the elements have the flag not set. And what I want to do, I want to grab those elements, I want to plug them into the middle. For instance, I mark up my emails in my email client, click, 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 drag them, and put them somewhere else. So if you want to implement this kind of algorithm, you probably would come up with a naive implementation which would look horrible. But as it turned out, you can very simply implement that by splitting that problem into two problems, the problem above the red line and below the red line. And now you can see that it's really just two partitioning steps I want to do. Above the red line, I want to get all elements which are not marked first and then the marked ones. And below the red lines, I want to get all of those which are marked and then the unmarked ones. And luckily, the standard template library already gives us a facility for that, which is called stable partition. And I created, or Sean created, a function which he called gather, which is called with four arguments. The first, the last of the whole sequence. P is the required insertion point where I want to drop the marked elements, and the binary predicate is a function which will be called for each element, which will decide whether that thing has been marked or not. So calls a stable partition from beginning to the insertion point, and does a partition with the inverted predicate, and then the stable partition from the insertion point to the end with a straight predicate. Stable partition gives you back the point of the partitioning. So the overall function gather gives you back the region of the where the marked objects have been inserted into the overall sequence. It's just two iterators which give you those. Now, what I want to show is what you can do and how you can create an asynchronous algorithm which does the same thing, but in an asynchronous manner, so that you can launch that thing, let it run on a side, and you get back a future which represents the execution of these two things. Well, I just called the function gather async now, and the difference is, the arguments are the same, but it now returns a future representing the pair of iterators. We use stable partition with the task execution policy. That means that this will be launched on a side. I get a future which represents the overall result for the one partition. I do the same for the other partition. I now have two futures representing the two executions of the two partitioning steps. And the interesting thing is that I already get a additional parallelization effect here, because not only each of the algorithms runs in parallel, but the two algorithms run at the same time, because they really just kick off the operation of those partitions. And the next code looks a bit more complex, and I will explain it, and I will simplify it in a second, so don't get too upset about it. What happens here is data flow is a function which is very much like async. It gets a function to call on a new thread and a set of arguments. And if one or more of the arguments to data flow, in this case F1 and F2, are futures, then data flow will wait with launching the new thread until all the futures have become ready. So it will just delay the scheduling of the function, which in our case is that return make R1, R2. And it will pass those arguments directly to the function. The unwrapped facility here, you can see that lambda is put into an unwrapped, just gets rid of the futures. It just, since we know that the function will be invoked only at the point when the futures have become ready, we can simply call get, and unwrap does this for us and forwards the actual values. So data flow will return a future to the result of the function, which in our case is the future to the pair of iterators we want to have. Well, you might say, that's complex code. I don't want to write this kind of code. Well, here, Gore's proposal of coroutines comes in, because if you use co-await, which is the one part of the coroutine proposal, you get exactly the same semantics in an absolutely straight way. Essentially, what we've done is we turned our straight code, which Sean wrote 3 years ago, into the equivalent asynchronous code just by changing two small things. We changed the execution policy and we added the co-await to get the values out of the futures. And we did another thing. If you think about it, what does that function do? That function gives me a future representing the pair of iterators, and that future depends on two other futures which are returned from the partitioning steps. So essentially this function gives you an execution tree which represents the execution of your algorithm you have inside. So we turned our code, which was straight synchronous execution, into a code which does not do anything but giving you an execution tree representing the algorithm. And when that execution tree is executed, you actually do the work and you get the result. So essentially it's auto-parallelization, because the execution of that execution tree can be performed at full speed. It will just flow. There will be no synchronization. It will just fully parallelize, utilize the system to the full extent. And that technique, which we call futurization, can be applied to arbitrary complex algorithms. So you take your textbook algorithm, apply the futurization technique, and you get a fully automatically parallelized algorithm, just like that, just by using futures as the data dependencies, because futures represent data dependencies, nothing else. Okay, another couple of examples. You might have heard of the stream benchmark. The stream benchmark is usually used to assess the memory bandwidth available on a particular architecture. The original stream benchmark is available on the web and usually uses for assessing the memory bandwidth on a single node, usually uses OpenMP. So I will compare these stream benchmark results with the original OpenMP benchmark with implementing the same thing without parallel algorithms. The stream benchmark essentially does four things. It's four loops. It's three arrays. And you perform four loops over those arrays. You do a copy step, a scale step, you add two of the arrays, and then you have a triad step where you access two arrays and multiply one of the factors with it and assign it to the third one. So the best possible performance in this case on a single node is certainly only possible when you have NUMA awareness, when you place the data close to your NUMA, to your socket where you run the code on, because as soon as you have cross NUMA domain traffic, you just kill the performance. In OpenMP, that's done implicitly by a so-called first touch policy. So you have to rely on very arcane low-level features to make sure that the thread is really run on the same socket where the corresponding data is located. And you use that pragma, OpenMP Parallel, and you schedule statically. And with parallel algorithms, that looks like this. You just have three vectors, you init the data, you run the copy step with a parallel execution policy, you run the transform, which is doing the scaling, another transform, which is doing, well, a binary transform, which is adding the two arrays, and another binary transform, which is performing the triad step. Nothing else. So it's really just four parallel for loops, or four parallel algorithms, one after another, and that mimics 100% the way OpenMP is measuring that memory bandwidth. Now let's do that on a CPU target. I create an object which is called host target, give it some initialization, tell it, hey, run on NUMA domain 0, for instance. I create a executor and a allocator from that target, which will make sure that the code will be executed on NUMA domain 0 and the data is allocated on the same, very close to that socket. And then I create three vectors, A, B, and C, using that allocator, which makes sure that the data is located on that memory close to this, the NUMA domain 0. And then I create an execution policy where I rebind the executor and tell it to do static chunking. Well, and the rest is history. The rest is really the same code as before, except that instead of the par execution policy, I use my rebound execution policy, and that's it. If you look at what we get when we run it on one NUMA domain, the green line is what we get with the parallel algorithms. The blue line above is what the original OpenMP benchmark gives us, so we reach about 97% of the performance. And we haven't looked too closely into it to optimize this even further, but I think we can still squeeze out the remaining 3%. So essentially we get equivalent performance to what OpenMP gives us today, with full control over memory placement from a very high level. When we run the same code on two NUMA domains, you see very similar behavior. There's still a 5% abstraction penalty, I'd say, we currently have to deal with. But I think we should be able to, and we will be able to find or to optimize that and reach the full OpenMP performance. I know Bjarne said this morning, we want to have a speed up of 10. I would like to have a speed up of 10 as well. But please keep in mind that OpenMP really perfectly utilizes the memory bandwidth here. So we are dealing with hardware limitations, not with code limitations. So reaching the OpenMP performance is the best we can do. Now let's run the same thing on a GPU. This time we create a target where we specify which device actually to use. Create a different type of allocator and different type of executor. Create local data on the CPU, which we will copy over to the device. Create our three vectors A, B, and C. These three will be allocated on the device. Then we copy the data from the CPU over to the device. And look, we use standard copy. And that standard copy just copies the local data over to the device. And please note, if we were using, instead of par, if we were using par task as an execution policy, that copy operation would give us a future which would allow us to completely overlap the operation of copying data from the CPU over to the device behind code on the CPU. So we wouldn't have to do anything special there. And then, well, the stream benchmark as it was before, there's no change there. So almost the same code, the only difference is that we have two different types for the executor and for the allocator here, and things will run on a GPU. And if you look at the data we get here, we can see that for very small array sizes, the overheads are significant, and that's probably because of, and that's compared with native CUDA. The overheads come mostly from the synchronization with the CPU code, where we rely on CUDA invoking a callback function in the user code, and this relies on operating system context switching. CUDA itself doesn't rely on that, so the overheads come from here. But for decently sized arrays, you can see that we essentially reach the same performance as a native CUDA implementation of the stream benchmark for on the right-hand side. So if you zoom in on the largest array sizes here, you can see that for compared to OpenMP, we reach 95%, as I said, and for CUDA, we reach 99% of the performance possible. So again, the C++ abstractions, how powerful they are, and as you can see, they're very versatile and completely under your control, don't impose any significant overhead over the native implementations of the underlying runtime systems, which companies have been developing for 25 years, I don't know. Okay, the last example, vectorization, and I think I'm, yeah, I still have 5 minutes, right? Let's do a dot product of two vectors. Just floats for simplicity here, and we can use inner product, which is a parallel algorithms, which is part of the parallelism TS. And I hope everybody knows what a dot product is. You take a pairwise, you multiply the two vectors pairwise and add up all the results, essentially. So it's a basic operation needed for matrix multiplications, mainly, and for other linear algebra problems. So the inner product gets two, we pass two operators to it, the operator to be used to do the pairwise operation, which is the second one, and the operator which is used to sum up all the results, which is the first of the two operators. So it's essentially plus and multiplies. And please note, I specifically used C++ 14 generic lambdas here. And this is just giving you parallel performance, parallel execution of that dot product, which is very nice. But if you change just the execution policy from par to data par, you get, in addition to parallelization, you get vectorization. And now these lambdas are being invoked with vector packs, so with a special data structure which consists out of four of the values, and the operations are performed vectorized on these four or eight, depending on the underlying hardware platform values. So you essentially gain, well, you get vectorization for free. So let me show some data here. This is what you see for two vectors of 100,000 floats. For the y-axis is the speed up, and the x-axis is the number of cores this loop runs. When you run it on one core, you can see that just by changing the execution policy, you get a speed up of 3, which is significant. So all you have to do, you change par for data par, and you get a speed up of 3. Isn't that great? In addition, when you run this parallel loop on more than one core, you still see a speed up, but the speed up is not as significant anymore. And the red dotted line gives you the ratio between the blue and the green line. So the speed up from parallel to vectorized and parallel code is in between 1.3 and 3, roughly. This is a fairly small array, 100,000 points. And here, the parallelization overhead, you can see that the parallelization overhead kicks in fairly massively. So you don't really scale up the, as well as you might want. So if you look at the same for a array size of 1 million, you have almost perfect scaling for the parallel case. And you see now that the speed up of the vectorization isn't breaking that fast anymore. This problem still fits into level 3 cache. So you can see for certain array sizes, you can really gain a lot from just changing that execution policy. And the last one is for 10 million points. And here the problem doesn't fit into the caches anymore, so additional memory access overheads have to be accounted for. So the effect is not as massive anymore as before. But you still can, just by changing the execution policy, you can still see a speed up of at least 1.3 to 2.5 or so. Very nice result, because it's essentially cheap, right? All you do is, just instead of par, you write data par, and you get some speed up. It might not be completely optimal, but you get a very, very nice first step in optimizing your code. Let me Yeah, so I'll skip the example on was a partition vector because time's running out. Essentially, what this code shows you how to you can use a partition vector and distribute the partitions over several nodes, and by changing the target object, do the same on a bunch of GPUs. So no code change, and you distribute the partitions over the GPUs, and then you run the parallel algorithms on those partitions in parallel without you having to deal with the partitions and so on. So very nice. The very last example, and then I'll stop. If you have this for loop and you have a parallel execution policy, and as you can see, this loop works on three arrays, wouldn't it be nice if we could prefetch B and C a couple of iterations ahead of time so that the hardware prefetching could make sure that B and C are in the caches when we need them? Well, the easy solution is this. We just say par with prefetch B and C, and that's it. So you can write very powerful means of customizing the way these parallel algorithms work, and you can really drill in and optimize things and turn knobs as you wish, and get very, very nice performance, because what this prefetching does is just gives you about 10-15% speed up just by prefetching these two arrays. And I think I'll skip that. I think that's it. So I thank you for your attention. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.